everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you in the driver's seat. And Tom Fairbanks on the other side of the glass, engineering and producing our show. Looks like a pretty good weekend, Tom. However, the very warm temperatures, may I dare say, excess heat coming maybe toward the end of next week. So
that's what they are saying.
Can we ever put 109, 110 degrees in the rearview mirror, at least for 2023? Buckmaster in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. They have the naming rights for our studio, and I'm darn glad they do. It's Friday, August 11th, 2023, the radio station. We're coming to you on 1030 KVOI, Tucson's trusted voice for news and talk. We begin year 14 with our radio project in January, 36 years on TV and radio in Tucson, worldwide live listening of our program at buckmastershow.com. That's also the place for all of our podcasts, going back to when we launched the radio project in January of 2011. Our live line for our telephone interviews, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Our media friends, Friday we do a media shout-out. These are folks who prominently display the Buckmaster Show logo on their website. They just click on the Buckmaster Show logo from their website. Goes right to us. TucsonSentinel.com. Thanks, Dylan and the team. Green Valley News and Saharita's son, Dan Shear, and his team. Tucson Local Media Group. Their portfolio includes Inside Tucson Business, Tucson Weekly, Oro Valley Explorer, Marana News, Foothills News, and Desert Times. Joining me in studio today, my co-media host, Jim Ninsel, who spent more than 30 years with the Tucson Weekly. And July 1, he became the political reporter for TucsonSentinel.com. Hey, Jim, how are you?
I'm doing well, Bill.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program. And Jim, we go back a long way and on the TV show on Arizona Illustrated. And how many times did we have Tom Horn on the program?
Once a month, it seems.
I know. A lot of times. Tom Horn, superintendent of public instruction for the state of Arizona after 24 years as a local school board member. Mr. Horn also served 4 years as a state lawmaker. He served as the elected superintendent of public instruction from 2003 to 2011. In 2020, he was elected state schools chief again. A Republican, Tom Horn served as the 25th Attorney General of Arizona from 2011 to 2015, but lost to Mark Brnovich in the 2014 Republican election. Mr. Horn, Superintendent Horn, how are you?
Bill, it's always great to be with you, and you've been interviewing me for 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years. Isn't that is really amazing. Let's begin with the school voucher situation. Parents, am I hearing, Mr. Horn, something in the background there?
Yeah, I'm in the back room of a restaurant. I had a lunch scheduled at 11, so but they were kind enough to reserve the back room for me. So
okay, all right. There you go. The vouchers, parents of any of the 1.1 million public school students in the state may instead use the expanded empowerment scholarship account to divert the money public schools spend on their children to private schools of their choosing. Here's the rub, Tom Horn. Arizona can't afford it. That's what many are saying now. Can we afford this program?
Yes. The projections that you've been reading in the paper are incorrect. You have to remember, if someone leaves a public school to go to a private school, the state has saved the money at the public school, which is about $13,000 per student if we include state and local, which is, you know, taxpayers pay to both state and local. And then we give them $7,000. So it's a $6,000 savings to the state. Now, it didn't start out that way because the first people who got on this were richer people who had their kids in private school already. So you didn't have that offset. And they dominated in the early months. So it seemed like a big loss. But the trend is for people at all economic levels now. And so as that continues, more and more there'll be a savings rather than expense.
Yeah, but right now, aren't we looking at like a deficit of $300,000?
$300 million, I think.
$300,000.
Maybe I shouldn't have told you that. That's an incorrect projection in my mind for the reason I just said. Our office had to make an estimate of the total cost. The way the legislation was written, we couldn't allow for the offset for the savings to the public schools. So I think people thought it will cost $300 million, but it won't, because as the trend continues, where it's more and more people from lower economic groups, there'll be a savings with them rather than expense.
All right, let's bring our friend Jim Nintzel into the conversation. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, Jim. You interviewed me a number of times, too.
I have.
Yeah.
I wanted to just ask you about... the teacher retention issue and teacher shortage issue here in Arizona, where does that stand at this point?
It's horrendous. It's a real emergency. There are schools, especially in rural areas, there are schools where they just can't find the bodies that they need, and they're willing to take almost anybody as a substitute, and that's not good for the education of the kids. So this is a major problem. We have a task force examining it. My personal view is that there are three basic ways we can attack it. The first is we have got to pay our teachers more. No school is better than the quality of the teachers in the classroom. Surrounding states pay more, so we lose good teachers to other states. We can't afford to keep doing that. Matt Gress had a bill to give every teacher an extra $10,000. That would have put us in the top 10 in starting salaries in the country. He's a Republican legislator. And the Democrats and the teachers union opposed it just because it was coming from a Republican. We need to make this I was shocked by that. We need to make this a bipartisan effort. It has nothing to do with party. It has everything to do with the fact we need to be paying our teachers more. And so I'm trying very hard to make this a bipartisan effort. The second thing is we need to have administrators support teachers better on discipline. A number of teachers who leave, when teachers leave the profession, we survey them. And for a number of them, the number one reason is not salary. That's second. The first reason is that administrators didn't support them, especially on discipline. If you have no support on discipline, one kid gets away with something without consequences, and the others start to imitate that. And pretty soon you have a disorderly classroom that's very difficult to teach. And if I were a teacher in that circumstance, I'd leave the profession too. It is a terrible situation. I'm working very hard to persuade administrators to support their teachers on discipline. I served, as you mentioned, on a school board for 24 years, and we did not reverse a teacher one time on discipline, not one time in 24 years. Our learning went up. I mean, we became known as the toughest district around, but our learning went up, our test scores went up, trying to bring that philosophy to the state level. And then the third thing is we have to have academic success. Our statistics show in schools that have a lot of academic success, their turnover is zero, because the teachers have the satisfaction of achieving. It's in districts, it's in schools where it might not be as well run and they're not experiencing success, where they get frustrated and they leave. So those are the three things that I've been emphasizing. We have to push hard to solve this problem.
Do you see any connection between academic success and conditions in the home for students? For example, do you think in wealthier households, kids have more support and more expectations to go to school, perform well in school, while in lower income households, you have a lot of transition. Families have to move around a lot. The kids move in and out of different schools. Does that play an impact in the success of the students?
It does. And I mean, you're right. It does. But that can't be an excuse for us. The great Black philosopher Thomas Sowell wrote a book about successful schools in poor Black neighborhoods that do very well because the schools are well run. So even though the what's happening at home is a factor, that's not an excuse for us. We have to do the very best we can with all students. The students are entitled to an excellent education regardless of what zip code they're in.
Well, without a doubt. But how do you It seems like where you have schools where they're struggling like that, the state is, you know, taking away resources and giving them to the schools that do better with students. So I guess my question is, how do you turn those schools around?
Actually, the schools in poor areas get a lot more money than the other schools because of federal aid primarily. The amount they spend per pupil is more. Tucson Unified and Phoenix Union are the two districts that get the most money because they get what they call DSEG money, although I think segregation probably hasn't been an issue for many years, but they still get that money. So it's not an issue of funding. And we do have schools with low economic circumstances that do very well. I just visited a charter school like that where kids have very low economic circumstances, but their teaching is fabulous. I went from class to class. All the teachers were teaching phonics. They were going through the sounds of the letters with the kids. And they told me that by Christmas vacation, their kids were already reading. Their kindergartners were already reading.
So what do you see in those schools where you're seeing that success that could be replicated elsewhere?
A lot. And we're dedicated to that.
What would be the top two things that you're seeing in those schools that should be replicated elsewhere?
Good discipline, so you don't have discipline problems, and so the kids can learn, and good teaching methods like phonics with reading rather than whole language, which is a totally failed experiment. Good teaching of math, good leadership. Leadership is the primary thing, I would say. George Washington said he'd rather have an army of lambs led by a lion than an army of lions led by a lamb. And there's something to that. I think all successful schools have good principals and good superintendents.
And when you say good, can you elaborate on what qualities you're talking about there?
Yes, they're academically oriented. Their goal is good performance rather than the distractions that we've been subject to in recent years, like social emotional learning and critical race theory and inappropriate sexual stuff and so on. They're not captured by those distractions. They're focused on academics. We want the students to be taught academics from bell to bell with the philosophy that every instructional minute is precious. And I think it's time on task. There was a professor at a Midwestern university who did a federally funded time on task study, and he concluded the more time students spent learning something, the more of it they learned. And his mother said to him, "You needed a federally funded study to tell you that?"
All right. We're speaking with Tom.
It's pretty obvious to all of us. So we've got to get time on task on our academics.
All right. We're speaking with Tom Horn, Arizona school superintendent. You created the Arizona Department of Education Empower Hotline to take calls reporting, quote, inappropriate lessons that detract from teaching academic standards. The last time you were on the show, you said that the calls, you just were overwhelmed with crank calls. How's that going now?
Well, we have always ignored the crank calls. I think our opponents took note that in Virginia they closed their line that they had set up because they got too many crank calls. I've got a little more tenacity than that. We just ignore the crank calls. And we've gotten some interesting calls. I think the most interesting call we got was not from a parent, but from a teacher who was objecting to professional development in the Mesa School District. And she actually sent us a picture of the visual they had, which said explicitly that the United States was a white supremacist country. That should play no role in education of kids, that kind of biased statement.
All right. Was that a mandated course or an optional course that teachers could take that you just referenced?
You know, she didn't tell us. All she said was that she was at a professional development course and she was shocked at what they were telling the teachers to teach the kids.
You didn't look into whether it was mandatory or optional?
I didn't. I just focused on it, and I don't think they're doing that anymore.
So
it doesn't matter whether it's required or optional. The point is, teachers shouldn't be told to teach kids that the United States is a white supremacist country. The United States is a country of opportunity. That's why so many immigrants come here and go through terrible circumstances to try to get here illegally. because they know that the United States is the land of opportunity, and any individual who works hard is going to be successful.
All right, let's pause right here. It's time to take our first break. Superintendent Tom Horn with us on our live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Jim Nitzel from TucsonSentinel.com is with me in studios. When we come back with Mr. Horn, school absenteeism just pretty much at record levels, out of control in many areas around the country since schools reopened during the pandemic. We'll talk with Mr. Horn about that right after this.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Welcome back. It is Bill Buckmaster. It's the Buckmaster Show. Our Friday Focus interview today, the Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of Arizona, Tom Horn, is with us on our live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Jim Nitzel is here from TucsonSentinel.com. What are we going to do, Mr. Horn, about this absenteeism? Record rates at schools since the schools reopened during the pandemic. A lot of students just since the pandemic just aren't coming back to school.
Well, it's a terrible problem because you can't teach kids who aren't there. And if we're going to raise our academics, we have to have good attendance as well. There have to be consequences if students have excessive absences. I had a meeting with some people from a nonprofit that works in education, and she was telling me, well, you shouldn't suspend a student for bad attendance because it means that they'll be staying home more. And I have a different point of view, which comes from my 24 years on the school board. If we were talking about suspending or expelling a student, the parents had a right to come in to appeal. It never did them any good, but they had the right to do that. And typically the mother would be crying, the father would be yelling, And that was just what I wanted. We got their attention. And then they got the students' attention, the behavior changed. And so, you know, one thing is, if as academics improve, students will want to come because they enjoy a good class. But the other thing is, there have to be consequences for misbehavior. And so we've got to bring that back. And that's what I'm determined to do.
You are a staunch proponent of English language immersion instruction, and you've warned schools in the state they risk losing education funding if they allow students not yet proficient in English to participate in these 50-50 dual language programs where half the day is taught in English, the rest of the day is taught in Spanish or some other language. There's a big disagreement between you and the Attorney General, Chris Mays, who will be on our program 1 week from today. Where are we right now on this dust-up over dual language programs?
Well, I think there are 2 points to make. First, what's in the academic interest of the students? And secondly, what does the law require? So let me take academic interest of the students first. When I took office in 2003, there had been an initiative in effect since 2000 requiring structured English immersion rather than bilingual education. But it hadn't been enforced by my two predecessors. And Lisa Graham Keegan, one of my predecessors, had reported to the legislature that the number of students becoming proficient in English in 1 year was 4%. That is a pathetic number. At 4% a year, most students would never become proficient in English, and they just fail in the economy. I enforced the initiative for the first time. We brought in structured English immersion. We put a lot of focus on teaching the teachers how to do it, and we got the proficiency rate up to 31% in a year. So at that rate, in 3 or 4 years, almost everybody becomes proficient in English. So we've demonstrated that in the interest of the student is to have structured English immersion, even though some people are ideologically or sentimentally attached to having the native language taught for part of the day. It's not in the interest of the students. I describe it as feel-good mediocrity versus data-based excellence. Now, as far as the law goes, the initiative requires that the students, that the classes students are in, if they're English language learners, be taught in English. It says that in so many words, it's a very simple sentence. The state board asked the Attorney General for an opinion. I'm sure she wanted, because of her ideology and her political ambitions, she wanted to say that it was okay under the initiative to have the dual language. But she knew she couldn't because the sentence is clear. So she expressly said she was not deciding that. And what she said was that I don't have the power to enforce it. It's with the state board. Well, we always knew if I wanted to withhold funds, I go to the state board and they're the ones that do it. But there are other things in the statute. If school board members and superintendents, if they violate the statute, any parent can sue them. Any parent in the state can sue them. And if they lose, they lose their office and they can't run for re-election for 5 years. So there are other sanctions in the voter protected initiative. Now, what she said in her opinion was that the school districts could rely because the state board had adopted four models, the fourth of which involved dual language, that they could reasonably rely on that. And that's just flat wrong. Nobody can supersede a voter protected initiative, not the legislature, not the state board, not the attorney general. It's illegal. And nobody has a right to rely on anything else than the letter of the law. And I will continue letting the districts, the schools know that. And ultimately, there'll be litigation and we'll get a decision from a judge. And I have no doubt that the courts will come down on the express language of the initiative.
All right, Jim Nentzel with me in studio, but Matt has been waiting very long on the live line. Matt, a quick question for Tom Horn, please, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Superintendent Horn. Tom, I think the elephant in the room, probably that Jim eventually is going to get to, is the ESA vouchers and the studies done by probably the governor's office and maybe even GBL's JBLC, with regards to the potential explosion in the cost. You know, the program's gone from approximately 6,000 to 60,000 people, students participating in it. And you decried, you know, DSEG money, which is money that basically saved the largest school districts in their ability to function in difficult circumstances. But is not this the same thing? You're basically transferring the money that's, you know, allocated to have a responsible school system in Arizona that functions, both charter and public school, and you're basically giving this money now to private entities.
We spent about 10 minutes. We spent about 10 minutes at the beginning of the show.
I apologize. I got to you guys late.
You got to the show late, so.
Yeah. I'll listen to the reel. Okay, thank you.
Let me just say I want to thank Matt for calling, and we did cover it, but I can give him a very quick, compressed answer,
please.
And that is when you include $13,000 per student saved when they leave the public schools, and we give them $7,000, is actually a benefit to the state of $6,000. And the calculation he's talking about did not take that into account, only the expense, not the offset.
All right. Now, here's Jim Nintzel from TucsonSentinel.com.
Yeah, I think one thing that Matt did touch on there is the fact that charter schools and public schools are subject to regulation by the state, but private schools are not. Are you at all concerned that some private schools may be teaching things that, you know, they may be involved in that we don't know what's being taught in some of these private schools.
Right.
I guess I'll leave it there.
Well, yeah, this was a decision of the legislature. And as time goes on, if I think adjustments are needed, I'll certainly let the legislature know. But this was the thinking of the legislature. Almost all people want to have their kids in the neighborhood school. We've got 1,100,000 kids in the neighborhood schools or charter schools and only 60,000 in the ESAs. If they take the student out of school to put them in another school, that's a pretty significant decision. It means the public school is not meeting their needs, and they want to find a school that does meet their needs. And if they take them to a private school and this private school is not successful academically, then they're going to leave that private school. So the legislature felt in that circumstance, the parents would provide the accountability rather than the state having to do that. That was their reasoning.
Should we go ahead and advance that to public schools and charter schools and just say the parents will be keeping a close eye on things and we don't need these regulations in public schools?
No, it's not that unusual decision for parents to send their student to the neighborhood school. Everybody does it, you know, other than 60,000 versus 1,100,000. Everybody sends their kids to the neighborhood school. It's not a deliberate decision to send your kids to the neighborhood school. You do it automatically. I did it automatically. I'm a public school person. My four children went to public schools. They did very well. And 90% of my job is to improve academics in the public schools. That's my main duty and obligation and responsibility. The unusual thing is to take your student out of a public school and put them in a private school. And there, if the private school does not perform, I have no doubt but that the parents would take them out and place them elsewhere.
I wonder, you know, you were an early, you were against CRT before being against CRT was cool, I think.
You got it.
You weighed in on that.
Yeah, for about 10 years, I was a voice in the wilderness, and the world caught up with me.
Yeah, and so, you know, we're seeing now in some states a suggestion that, you know, we should teach kids that, you know, slaves learned skills that really helped them later in their lives and things of that nature, that
really,
slavery wasn't so bad. And I'm just wondering...
That's crazy. Completely crazy. I would not dream to defend what Florida has done. I think it's completely crazy to teach that. Slavery was the greatest evil in the history of humanity, really. And it was terrible. They broke up families. People labored from dawn to dusk. I remember reading one slave saying, wrote something where he said, you know, the sun never rises for the slave. It's miserable day after day. I could not defend that, and I would not defend it, and I condemn any statement like that. And it makes no sense to say they got the skills of being a blacksmith. In the North, people got the skills of being a blacksmith without being slaves. You don't need slavery to teach people how to be a blacksmith. It's ridiculous.
All right. One thing we did not cover with you the last time you were on the show, the federal judge's ruling on the challenge to the Arizona law prohibiting biological boys from participating in girls' sports. What's the latest on that?
Well, that was on a preliminary injunction. We still have to go to the main event, and if necessary, we'll appeal. I think this is an important issue to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I have no doubt that we would win in this in the U.S. Supreme Court if we had to go that far. The problem is that there's a difference between males and females. Males have bigger muscles, bigger bone structure, and we've seen, we read in the paper all the time about girls who worked hard to succeed in athletics. They dreamed of making the varsity team or getting a college scholarship or even going to the Olympics, and they work and work and work, and then all of a sudden a male gets into the competition, and their dreams are they're devastated. Their dreams are shattered, and I think people need to have sympathy for them. That it's a terrible injustice on them. This case involves students where the plaintiffs are trying to start with what they think is an easy start, which is students that have males with puberty blockers, and they claim that they don't have the advantage, but they really do have the advantage. We submitted a number of peer-reviewed studies, peer-reviewed meaning objectively verified studies, that shows that even pre-puberty, the boys have an advantage. Ask any elementary school coach, and they'll tell you that boys are on the average better than girls at athletics before puberty. This is a case I'm defending. I'm the only one defending this case. The legislature was allowed to do it through the preliminary injunction, but for the rest of it, I'm the only one. They sued four people. The other three conceded, so I'm the one who's defending that. And I'm very passionate about it. I think it's cosmically unfair to subject girls and women who dreamed of success in academics, and Title IX was supposed to guarantee them that opportunity, to be unable to compete because biological males are able to compete against them.
And how many times have we seen a trans athlete defeat a female athlete here in Arizona?
I don't know about Arizona, but there are a lot of famous examples on the national scale. You have a male swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania who was number 455 when he was competing in the males, started competing against the females, and he was winning all the championships. And the women who were being denied those championships were treated very unjustly.
But
there are a lot of examples of that.
You haven't heard of it happening in Arizona?
I have not heard of it happening in Arizona, but I don't think it makes any difference. It's happened on the national level, and we have to fight for the law that was passed by the legislature that says biological males cannot compete in female sports. And the attorney general, who is obligated to defend state laws, refused to defend it, refused to provide lawyers to me to defend it. I have to pay money. She's budgeted money for to defend cases. I'm budgeted money for education. I'm having to use education money to defend it because she's ignoring her duty, which is to defend state laws and to represent departments. And there may well be litigation over that as well.
All righty. We've only got a couple of minutes, and I've got two callers that'd like to take their questions. Let's begin. Donna, a quick question, please, for Tom Horn.
No, I just want to correct him. That wasn't what the slavery syllabus said. They didn't say that this was great for blacks because they learned something. What they said, it was a black gentleman who was a PhD who put this in the curriculum, that the slaves were resourceful and they were able to overcome and learn something. It had nothing to do, not saying that the slave masters were so great to do it. The whole thing was so misconstrued. So that's all I wanted to say, and I'll hang up because I know there's another caller.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you know, I'm not going to defend what Florida did. Let me just use 1 minute to point also that when she refused to defend the case, the attorney general said she had a conflict. She did not have a conflict. A conflict, disagreeing with the law, is not a conflict. The attorney general, when I was attorney general, I defended laws I didn't agree with. The attorney general has a duty to do that. A conflict would be if she represented one of the parties, which she had not. So her refusal to defend that case was a derogation of duty.
All right, let's go to Bob. A couple of very quick questions for Tom Horn, Bob.
Good morning. Well, Yes, it is. So it's afternoon now. Hey, Tom, do you remember when TUSD did some experimentation with site-based decision-making at places like Miles Exploratory Learning Center?
I don't remember that. No, I'm sorry.
That's where the district, instead of being in charge of the school, they ceded all the power to the teachers and the parents and the students that went to that school. And we
How did it work out?
Pardon me?
How did it work out?
Bob, it worked out great.
I'm asking you, how did it work out?
It worked out great. We actually had large participations in our monthly meetings between parents and teachers. Some of the teachers actually left when we adopted that system because they didn't like the idea of parents being able to tell them what to do. But that school started out, and it was a real dirtbag school, and it was falling apart. There was plaster falling off the walls. And we all got together and convinced the district to actually renovate the school. And we started planting trees and gardens, putting up shades on the playgrounds where they just – anyways, I think it worked out real good. But
all right.
I don't even know if they do that anymore.
Thank you, Bob, for your input to the show today. Go ahead, Mr. Horn.
Let me say that our slogan when I took over as my new administration in the Department of Education is that we are a service organization. That's number one. We want to serve the schools to do better. A service organization dedicated to raising academic outcomes and to empower parents. And I think parents, no one cares more about a child than the parents, and I think they should be empowered, and I'm all for that.
All right. Any final thoughts, Mr. Horn, before we let you go?
Well, I'm grateful for you having me on. So many interviews are 5 or 10 minutes, and you give me the time to really talk about things, and I'm grateful for that, and I'd love to come back anytime you want to have me.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom Horn, Superintendent of Public Instruction. Have a great afternoon, Mr. Horn.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Going to talk with Jim Nintzel about some of the stories he's been producing, generating for TucsonSentinel.com. We'll talk with Jim right after the break.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Thinking about a river cruise? Let Bon Voyage Travel guide you to choose the perfect cruise to complement your vacation dreams. River cruising has become more popular than ever, and we know you have so many options to consider when selecting the destination, cruise line, and ship. At Bon Voyage Travel, we provide a comprehensive presentation on the top tips for river cruises and have a team of specialists to assist you. Visit bvtravel.com and view our River Cruise 101 presentation today.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Our thanks to Tom Horn, who appeared on our live line, presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. We are in the Green Things, Zocalo Village Studios. Jim Ninsel is here. Jim now has a little over a month under his belt for TucsonSentinel.com. Jim, it's going very well, and I know you're real pleased with the team that you've got over there.
Yeah, you know, I am just, you know, it's been probably 6 years, really, since I've been doing reporting, because I was in the editor's seat for so long, and you're stuck behind a desk, and you're not out on the street. So getting back out and talking to people has been an absolute joy. I'm enjoying it tremendously, and I love the people. This crew I'm working with is so dedicated and is working so hard. So I just can't say enough, and I was just blown away by the story that one of our interns, Natalie Robbins, did this week with Dylan Smith, our editor and publisher. And it's about this 22-year-old Minnesota man. He died in the Pima County Jail, and his family spent all this time trying to find him, posting on social media, calling the Tucson Police Department. And the Pima County Sheriff's Department just totally dropped the ball on notifying the family, did not make the effort they should have made. It would have taken very little time to get on Facebook and find the family.
Kin, right.
Right. Yeah. And they say, well, we don't use social media. Mm-hmm. We don't use Google. And, you know, it's absolutely appalling. The failure of the sheriff's department.
2.5 months?
2.5 months. And the only reason that they found out was because Natalie, looking over autopsy reports and comparing them to jail deaths and doing some sleuthing, actually discovered the man's family. So they would still be in the dark if it wasn't for the work that we're doing over at the Tucson Sentinel. And I suspect this story will be all over the TV stations, and they will not be giving us credit for
it.
But my God, just a great piece and a story everyone should read.
Yeah, Natalie Robbins.
Robbins, daughter of Ted Robbins.
Who I worked with and have the highest respect for.
Working
Ted
for
Robbins.
NPR now in Washington.
I worked with Ted at ACPM at Channel 6 for many years. What a great reporter. And sounds like the genes have carried over into his daughter. I remember Natalie, I probably shouldn't say this, but I remember Natalie when she was just a baby when she was first born.
Yeah.
Anyway, you had a couple of pieces too. Let's hit on one of them. Is there an effort now? What's this abortion initiative that might be on the ballot in 24?
Yeah, you have a whole large coalition of groups, Planned Parenthood, the Narrow Arizona, the Arizona List, and a few others that have come together expecting to spend $40 to $50 million next year, well, starting now, because they have to gather, you know, 370,000, you know, that's valid signatures, and you have to figure there's going to be invalid ones. So, you know, they're looking at gathering 500, 600, 700,000 signatures to ensure this gets on the ballot. But it would very basically amend the Arizona Constitution to ensure that women have a right to an abortion up until fetal viability, which will change through medical science, but generally 22 to 24 weeks at this point. And then beyond that, if there's some birth defect or some reason to be concerned about the mother's health or what have you, and that would, if approved by voters and put into the Arizona Constitution, would mean many of the laws that the Arizona legislature has passed in recent decades, whether it's, you know, the current 15-week ban, you know, there's this territorial era ban that, you know, is still in court, whether
1867 or something.
It's a crazy old law, and, you know, there's some you know, debate over which one should take precedence, and that's in the courts right now. But again, this amendment would put that legal argument to rest. There is also The idea is that this would give a legal pathway to overturning the other restrictions, the 24-hour waiting period, the mandatory ultrasounds, the restrictions on medication abortion that have to be treated very similar to a surgical abortion, even though they're completely different procedures. All that stuff would then be subject to legal challenge, we'd certainly have to see what the courts say, but so we'll see. I think the backers of it expect that it will pass. They obviously have done some polling ahead of mm-hmm. designing this thing. They kept it very simple, and I think the thought is also that it may raise turnout in Arizona and be helpful to Democrats in the 2024 election.
Only a few seconds left with Jim Nenzel, and you had said on this program, and I did agree with you, that it's so hard to beat an incumbent in a primary election in the city of Tucson.
It is, and you saw that in the primary election where the incumbents really dispatched their opponents by wide margins, and as we're looking into an analysis of the race, they didn't lose a single precinct in either competitive race here. So we're on to the general, and the Republicans have put up a slate of candidates, all rookies who are
recruited, right?
Yeah, they all basically say, you know, nobody else was going to do it, and the party really asked me to. So they've been drafted into this effort. You also have an independent candidate for mayor, Ed Ackerley, who told me he's been running ever since. He's been running for 5 years now because he never stopped after he lost to Raheena Romero in 2019. So we'll see what happens, but incumbents rarely lose in this town. So I think the challengers have their work cut out for them.
All righty, Jim Nenzel, we'll look for your work as you generate more stories for TucsonSentinel.com. Thanks, Jim.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, we'll take a break right here. Matt Russell with Weekend Watch, presented by Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, is coming up next.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com. And away we go. It's Weekend Watch presented by Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Only about a three-hour drive over to an area that I guarantee will be cooler. Well, it's about a mile high elevation, so you know it's going to be cooler. Look at that. 79 degrees. Very pleasant midday in Silver City. Start your planning by visiting southwestnewmexico.org. There you will find all sorts of very tempting ideas about how to recreate, some great places to stay, and great places to eat as well. And speaking of eating, longtime Tucson foodie and award-winning Tucson publicist, the longtime host of Weekend Watch, Matt Russell. Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm doing good. You know, food is always the segue, isn't it, Bill? I mean, it's a convenient segue for you as host to just mention food or beverage, and there I am.
There you are, and talk about beverage, right? We got a tasting going.
We sure do. You know, we talk a lot about beer and wine events here on Weekend Watch, but we rarely have the opportunity to chat about mead, which in fact is the world's oldest alcoholic beverage. It traces back to China to the year 6500 BC. And so, Bill,
what?
It's essentially, yes, indeed, it's essentially fermented honey that's mixed with various fruits and spices. And you can get some free samples of this magnificent mead today at 4 o'clock at 1912 Brewing Company on North Forbes. You'll be able to taste a few for free, as I said. Of course, you could purchase glasses and flights for longer-term enjoyment, and they're going to have some live music as well. So let the mead flow today at 1912 Brewing.
Boy, you know, I learned something every program. That's why I do this show. I had never heard of mead, M-E-A-D. Wow, sounds tempting.
It
sounds tempting. I like honey, so that's the first step, right?
Exactly.
How about Italian wine?
Yeah, you know, the tastings are going to continue tomorrow at Feast on Speedway. Chef Doug Levy and his crew are going to be hosting an Italian wine tasting at 2 o'clock to kind of prepare our palates for his big dinner next week to celebrate Ferragosto. So tomorrow there'll be four wines from the top of Italy to the bottom, including some reds and some whites. That's only $15 tasting fee for the entire spectrum. And then it's not during the weekend, but definitely plan to put next Tuesday on your calendar for their annual Ferragosto dinner. Bill, this actually has historic significance. It's not just the day that every Italian scampers to the coast with their Speedo on and wandering around with a gelato in their hand. This actually has actual significance, but all the information is on Feast's website.
What's going on at the fire?
Well, Tucson's 2022 Iron Chef Ken Foy of Dante's Fire, he recently took to the stage again to defend his belt, and boy, it was a repeat, Bill. He was crowned again as this year's Iron Chef, and to celebrate the victory, he's going to be recreating that four-course menu that earned him this year's honors at a special Iron Chef dinner on Sunday at Dante's Fire. And if you remember, each of the courses has to have a secret ingredient, and this year it was peanut butter, so sign me up. It's the Iron Chef dinner on Sunday at Dante's Fire.
I've always liked peanut butter, and I know you have too, so that sounds like a great starter.
We're in for a treat, my friend.
All right, Matt Russell, always a pleasure. Matt, have a great weekend, sir. Thank you.
All right, you too. Cheers, Bill.
All right, the Buckmaster Show is a presentation of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC. That organization is wholly responsible for the content of our program. Our original theme music composed by our German friend, his name is Christophan. Thanks to my assistant, Rosemary Brandt, and everybody here at KVOI. Rose makes sure all of our podcasts get up in a very timely manner, usually within a few hours of the conclusion of our program. And of course, KVOI and the whole Bustos Media team in Tucson, which includes my buddy Tom Fairbanks, engineering and producing the show. Be well, everybody. Stay safe, and I hope you all have a lovely weekend.